Good day, everyone. This is Ed at the Talking Information Center of the Massachusetts Radio Network, bringing you articles from The American Spectator magazine. We'll continue to read some articles from the fall of 2025 edition, as well as some articles from the winter 2026 edition. Our leadoff article from American Spectator this week is Obama's fingerprint, from American Greatness, is Paul Sperry's article, Obama's Fingerprints Are All Over Investigations of Trump and Clinton. In the run-up to the 2016 Democratic Party convention, FBI Director James Comey gained access to at least 8 thumb drives containing large volumes of former Secretary Hillary Clinton's sensitive State Department emails, as well as some from President Obama that appeared to have been compromised by foreign hackers. Instead of investigating this explosive new batch of evidence revealed recently in declassified documents, Comey rushed to close an investigation into whether Clinton improperly transmitted and received classified material from a private unsecured server she kept in her basement. Comey also took the extraordinary step of bypassing the Attorney General and personally exonerating Clinton of wrongdoing during an unusual press conference on July 5, 2016. Just hours later, Obama invited Clinton, who would be formally nominated as the Democratic standard bearer 3 weeks later, aboard Air Force One to help launch her multi-city campaign tour, during which he officially endorsed Clinton as his preferred White House successor. "I'm ready to pass the baton," Obama declared as he stumped for her for the first time. Comey's decision to remove the cloud of scandal over Clinton's campaign, allowing the president to get on with the business of campaigning for her, is just one avenue of investigation the Justice Department is pursuing in wide-ranging probes whose targets include a figure largely unscathed by his era scandals, former President Barack Obama. Attorney General Pam Bondi said prosecutors are investigating, among other things, possible coordination between the Clinton campaign and the Obama administration to interfere with 2016 presidential election. Jason Redding Quinones, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, has impaneled a grand jury to hear evidence related to an alleged grand criminal conspiracy by Obama and Biden officials to enlist law enforcement, intelligence agencies in rigging elections and carrying out political espionage against Donald Trump. The fate of these investigations is still unclear. Actions against former presidents, especially for conduct in office, have been exceedingly rare, with the exception of President Trump. And the courts have pushed back on the Trump administration's recent efforts to indict other Obama-era figures, including Comey. Nevertheless, a Real Clear Investigations looked at the evidence Trump administration prosecutors are presenting to the grand jury, which includes a raft of recently declassified CIA and FBI documents showing Obama's deep involvement in both protecting Clinton, advancing the conspiracy theory, and his advancing the conspiracy theory that Trump conspired with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Drawing from thousands of pages of documents, exclusive interviews with law enforcement and intelligence officials, RCI's analysis shows the former president was repeatedly at the center of the events surrounding both the closing of the Clinton investigation and the subsequent opening of several investigations targeting the Trump campaign. Post-election, Obama also ordered the manufacturing of anti-Trump intelligence, which set Trump's presidency up for continued investigations. On the tarmac, airports played an outsized role in the 2016 election. It was former President Bill Clinton's June 27th meeting with Attorney General Loretta Lynch on his parked plane at a Phoenix airport that reportedly convinced Comey that Lynch might appear compromised and they should go around the proper charging officer for federal crimes to clear his wife. About a week later, Obama signaled the all-clear after Comey's press conference by inviting Hillary to fly campaign rallies on Air Force One. Obama said during their July 5th, 2016 rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, "I'm here today because I believe in Hillary Clinton. I have had a front-row seat to her judgment and her commitment." Some presidential security experts and Secret Service sources contacted by RCI said the timing of the trip was suspicious. They point out that the president authorizing Clinton to fly aboard Air Force One on the same day his handpicked FBI director absolved her of crimes was almost certainly not a last-minute decision because it would have required extensive pre-planning. A veteran Secret Service official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive matter. The security involved in setting up that tour took weeks of advance work, which Obama knew she was going to be cleared and not charged. Obama wasn't going to risk endorsing her and joining her on the campaign trail without her first being cleared of federal crimes. He added, he knew about the end of the investigation well ahead of time. Although the FBI did not interview Clinton about her emails until July 2, 2016, Comey had been circulating drafts of his exoneration statement at FBI headquarters for months and conveying to agents that there was an extraordinary sense of urgency to complete the investigation, according to the declassified documents released recently by the Justice Department. Critics noted that the reasoning he offered for clearing Clinton in his July 5th statement was rife with contradictions. Comey said, although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. End quote from Mr. Comey. It is not known if any of the drafts were shared with the White House. Secret Service entry logs show Comey visited with Obama at least three times in 2016. The timing and presumption that Clinton would eventually be the Democratic Party nominee for president was part of the defendant's decision-making process, according to court papers the Department of Justice filed in November, detailing why it alleges Comey predetermined Clinton's innocence. Pulling punches. The new evidence suggests that Comey wasn't acting alone. It indicates that Obama was more involved in the Clinton probe than previously reported, and that Comey, whose entire family supported Clinton, may have pulled his punches to placate the incumbent president and avoid getting on the wrong side of the woman he assumed would be Obama's successor. The recently declassified appendix of a 2018 report from the Department of Justice's Inspector General reviewing the integrity of the FBI's investigation of Clinton found that the FBI never searched the 8 thumb drives containing thousands of unexamined Clinton emails that were exfiltrated by foreign actors. Comey was first briefed about the new cache of evidence in May of 2016 when he began drafting his exoneration statement and then again a week later before he unilaterally exonerated Clinton. FBI lawyers admitted in internal written memos, also recently declassified, that the information was necessary to conduct a thorough and complete investigation and to assess the national security risks associated with the breaches from Clinton's use of a private email server, which cyber forensic analysts had already found contained at least 2,063 classified emails, some at the top secret / special access program level. They also thought it was necessary to divine the full scope of unauthorized disclosure of classified emails found on the former secretary's server and to identify any potential cyber intrusions on the server. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley said, they got some thumb drives that dealt with all these issues and they didn't even bother to go through them. It was a complete cover-up. End quote from Charles Grassley. The appendix also reveals Democratic National Committee communication suggesting that Obama's Attorney General Loretta Lynch was secretly in communication with the Clinton campaigns during the probe of her emails and assured campaign officials the FBI would go easy on her. According to the communications, which U.S. intelligence analysts determined were not fabrications, Obama was putting pressure on Comey through Lynch to get rid of Clinton's email scandal as early as January 2016. Not long after, Comey began drafting a statement exonerating Clinton, months before the FBI agents had ended their investigation. In her 2018 congressional deposition, Lynch testified that she never obstructed the probe or exerted any influence over it. But she has acknowledged that she had spoken to Comey about diminishing the probe's significance by referring to the email investigation in the press as a matter, in quotes, not an investigation. Lynch did not respond to requests for comments sent to her law firm. DNC communications from March 2016 revealed that Obama also sanctioned the use of administrative levers to scuttle the FBI's investigation of the Clinton Foundation. Recently declassified FBI documents showed that around the same time, FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe had ordered field agents to back off their investigation of Clinton Foundation donors and former Secretary of State Clinton as part of a possible pay-for-play scheme. McCabe did not respond to requests for comments sent to his attorney and to George Mason University, where he is a visiting professor. Just months earlier, McCabe and his wife Jill met with Virginia's then-Governor Terry McAuliffe, a longtime Clinton ally, who was at the governor's mansion in Richmond to discuss raising money for Mrs. McCabe's state Senate race. The Clinton campaign ended up pumping more than $675,000 into Jill McCabe's Democratic campaign. McAuliffe had long maintained a seat on the Clinton Foundation board. RCI has learned further that before moving to the D.C. area, the McCabes were 15-year neighbors of the Clintons in the hamlet of Chappaqua, according to property records. Then on July 20th, just 5 days before the start of the Democratic National Convention, FBI headquarters shut down the Clinton Foundation investigation. A just-declassified internal FBI document reveals agents were suddenly barred from issuing subpoenas, conducting interviews, or sharing bank information related to the case with other offices. Because, based on political sensitivity surrounding the Clinton Foundation, HQ warned field officers to avoid creating any impression we are investigating the Clinton Foundation or the Clintons. RCI made several requests for comments to Comey and Obama. Comey declined comment through his attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, who successfully defended him against federal perjury and obstruction charges. The Department of Justice is appealing the case, which was dismissed by a Clinton-appointed judge, not on merits but on the grounds that the federal prosecutor who indicted him had not been appointed properly. Obama's Washington office declined comment. At the same time, the White House insisted it had no prior knowledge of Comey's decisions. Trump, who was on the verge of accepting the Republican Party's presidential nomination, did not buy it. He accused Obama and Comey of running a rigged investigation of his Democratic opponent. Trump said on July 5th, 2016, it was no accident that charges were not recommended against Hillary, the exact same day as President Obama campaigns with her for the first time. Unbeknownst to Trump, July 5th would loom large for another reason. On the very day Obama's FBI cleared Clinton, it set sights on him. Using the FBI to smear Trump. That day, the Bureau received the first in a series of false reports alleging Trump conspired with Russia. The reports, authored by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele, then working as an FBI informant, were funded by Clinton's campaign. Weeks later, President Obama was personally warned by the CIA that the Clinton campaign was planning to create a foreign espionage scandal falsely tying Trump to Russia to distract attention from her own espionage investigation involving her use of private server to transmit classified emails. A declassified memo revealed that Clinton had personally approved a plan to smear and demonize Trump as a Putin stooge, which was proposed by one of her foreign policy advisors, Julianne Smith, who previously served as Vice President Joe Biden's deputy security advisor. Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, later testified in Special Counsel John Durham's investigation that Clinton personally approved a plan to claim Trump had a back channel to Putin through a Russian bank, an assertion that proved utterly baseless. Mook told a D.C. court in 2022, "We discussed it with Hillary. She agreed with the decision." According to the document, Smith said that the FBI, where Clinton had supporters, would help pour fuel on the fire, suggesting foreknowledge of the coming Russiagate investigation, which had not yet been formally opened. She added that they would also get a lot of hope from the IC, or intelligence community, where Clinton had a lot of sympathizers. Strikingly, there appears to be an understanding among Clinton campaign aides that the FBI and the CIA would get involved in an effort to kneecap Trump well before such an effort manifested in an official capacity. In addition, the campaign solicited help directly from the White House. In a July 25th text message exchange with another Clinton advisor, Smith reached out to Special Assistant to the President and National Security Council member for information about an investigation into Russia and Trump. She went as far as she could in divulging sensitive information, Trump told the other advisor. Sources say the Obama aide is believed to be Celeste Wallander, who at the time was also Senior Director for Russia and Eurasia on the National Security Council. Smith indicated she had contacted the OVP, or the Office of the Vice President. Smith told Durham she did not specifically remember any such idea to spread dirt on Trump. Wallander did not reply to requests for comment when contacted at her new position as Executive Director of the University of Pennsylvania's office in Washington. Grassley said that the new evidence, which he has fought for years to declassify, provides additional proof that the Clinton campaign believed elements of the Obama administration would help them achieve their political ends against Trump. The plan to tie Trump to Russia went primetime during the DNC convention, held from July 25th to July 28th. During his nationally televised convention speech on July 27th, Biden warned, "We cannot elect a man who belittles our closest allies, while embracing dictators like Vladimir Putin." Obama pitched in during his own speech the following night, claiming that Trump cozies up to Putin. Comey also knew about Clinton's plan to manufacture a smear campaign against Trump, according to Durham. Yet on July 31st, 2016, he approved the opening of the codenamed Crossfire Hurricane espionage investigations of the Trump campaign for alleged, and since disproven, collusion with Russia. 3 months later, Comey even obtained a wiretap to spy on one of Trump's campaign advisors, Carter Page, based almost entirely on the false allegations in the Clinton-funded Steele dossier. The Russia probe was headed by Peter Strzok, the same FBI counterintelligence official who led the Clinton email probe. Internal FBI communications strongly suggest Strzok plotted to take a hard line against Trump. On July 31st, Strzok texted FBI lawyer Lisa Page, who worked directly under Comey's deputy, Andrew McCabe, to discuss the difference in the two investigations. He emphasized that the Trump case mattered more than the Clinton case and suggested the FBI merely checked the boxes in its investigation of Clinton. Strzok said, "Damn, this feels momentous, because this matters. The other one did too, but that was to ensure we didn't F something up. This matters because this matters," in caps. "So super glad to be on this voyage with you." The White House is running this. Strzok would soon learn that he was the nominal head of the investigation. On August 3rd, Obama met with Biden, Comey, and several other officials inside the White House to discuss the Clinton plan to link Trump and Putin, according to declassified records. The next day, Strzok attended a meeting with CIA officials as part of an interagency group on Russia and Trump created by then-CIA Director John Brennan. Known as the Fusion Cell, the group was quarterbacked by CIA official Liz Vogt, V-O-G-T. The following day, Strzok texted his FBI partner, Page, about the meeting, stating, "Went well, best we could have expected," he said, though he seemed annoyed to hear his investigation was under the control of the president. Other than Liz's quote, "The White House is running this," he added. Nevertheless, their goals were aligned: help Hillary Clinton, hurt Donald Trump. Strzok and Page had earlier agreed to aggressively probe Trump to stop him from being president, in contrast to the softball approach they endeavored to take investigating Clinton. Page wrote back to Strzok, "One more thing. Clinton may be our next president. The last thing you need to do is going in there loaded for bear." "Agreed," Strzok replied before interviewing Clinton. Both Strzok and Page have been subpoenaed by the recently impaneled federal grand jury hearing conspiracy evidence. Instead of alerting the Trump campaign about the Bureau's concerns, Strzok dusted off the rarely used law, the Foreign Agent Registration Act, to open additional espionage cases targeting Trump campaign officials Paul Manafort, codenamed Crossfire Fury, George Papadopoulos, Crossfire Typhoon, and Carter Page, Crossfire Dragon. The following week, he used the Foreign Agents Registration Act to open another counterintelligence case on Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn under the codename Crossfire Razor. In a September 2nd, 2016 text exchange, Page wrote Strzok that she was preparing talking points for Comey to brief Obama on their progress because POTUS, President of the United States, wants to know everything we're doing. Also, Obama appeared to be directing political strategy for the Democratic ticket from the White House. In October 2016, Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, was caught on video saying Obama had called him the prior night to warn him Trump was in bed with the fascist Putin. In a conversation captured in the 2020 documentary, Hillary, Kaine said, "The president demanded that he and Clinton go hard on Trump." "Tim, remember, this is no time to be a purist. You've got to keep a fascist out of the White House," Clinton is overheard saying. "I echo that sentiment," and hints at a nefarious relationship between Trump and Russia. A little more than a week before the election, Comey reluctantly reopened Clinton's email case, a controversial decision he made only after New York FBI agent John Robertson blew the whistle on headquarters trying to bury the discovery a month earlier of more than 300,000 new Clinton State Department emails he found on a laptop that Clinton confidant Huma Abedin shared with her then-husband Anthony Weiner, a former Democratic lawmaker from New York, as RCI first reported. Former prosecutor and assistant FBI director Chris Swecker said in an RCI interview, "The only reason Comey reopened the investigation is that the New York office threatened to bypass FBI headquarters to go straight to the Department of Justice regarding the additional emails that were discovered as a result of the Weiner sex crimes investigations." Around the same time, McCabe denied field agents particularly valuable evidence from the Weiner laptop that could have justified reopening their Clinton Foundation probes. Recently declassified FBI records also reveal. After Trump defeated Clinton the following month, Obama doubled down, ordering U.S. intelligence agencies to revisit their prior assessments that found no evidence that the Russian government had tried to hack the election for Trump. Within just 3 weeks of Obama's December 9th order, the CIA came up with new evidence to conclude Putin personally launched an influence operation to help swing the race to Trump. The publicly released version of the assessment, which helped Clinton and Obama explain her shocking defeat, hid the fact that the CIA relied in part on the Clinton-funded dossier to reach its new conclusion. Intelligence contradicting the key judgment that Putin helped Trump win was omitted from the assessment known as the ICA. Career analysts objected to using the dossier, but Obama's CIA Chief Brennan, overruled them. At least one senior intelligence analyst, now a whistleblower cooperating with the DOJ, its ongoing investigation of the entire scandal, said he was threatened by superiors to change his pre-election assessment to suggest Putin stole the election for Trump. The Obama White House even prevented analysts preparing the new assessment from seeing the incrimination so-called Clinton plan intelligence that exposed the plot to frame Trump as a Russian conspirator. In denying ICA drafters access to the intel, the White House spuriously claimed it was holding the material on grounds of executive privilege, according to a secret congressional report that debunked the intelligence behind the ICA. The explosive 2018 report had been locked in a safe at CIA headquarters until its declassification and release in July. On December 15, 2016, weeks before the assessment had been finalized, Obama let it slip out in an NPR exit interview at the White House that his intelligence team had essentially predetermined the conclusion of the Trump-Russia assessment. He said that no one should be surprised by the CIA assessment that this Russian meddling in the election was done purposely to improve Trump's chances of winning. Trump even suggested that Putin was helping the Trump campaign. He added, this is President Obama, "So what the CIA is now assessing, which was done purposely to tilt the election in the direction of a particular candidate, shouldn't be a surprise to anybody." Standing in the wings, Susan Rice, the president's national security advisor, sent Obama back into the room following the interview to reassert that the assessment was still under review. "You have something to add?" asked NPR's Steve Inskeep. He said, "It is worth noting that when it comes to the motivation of the Russians, there is still a whole range of assessments taking place at the agencies." A clearly chagrined Obama said, his voice cracking. So when I receive a final report, we'll be able to, I think, give us a comprehensive and best guess as to these motivations." Close quote. He stressed that different agencies are still looking at all the stuff, gathering it together and hopefully putting it into a single package. In fact, only 3 of the 17 intelligence agencies were involved in the process: the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA, and only 5 analysts drafted the final intel report, all of whom were hand-picked by Obama's CIA Director Brennan, who previously worked for Obama in the White House. Obama's intelligence czar, James Clapper, revealed later in a 2018 interview that the Obama-ordered assessment set off a chain of investigations targeting Trump and his administration over Russia. Clapper told CNN, "If it weren't for President Obama, we might not have done the intelligence community assessment that we did that set up a whole sequence of events which are still unfolding today, notably Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. President Obama is responsible for that." Recently declassified emails revealed that after taking his marching orders from Obama, Clapper pressured the NSA, which had partially dissented from the key judgment that Putin personally intervened in the election to help Trump, to get on the same page and be supportive of the conclusion. He suggested they will all have to compromise their normal standards for intelligence gathering to rush out the report to meet Obama's deadline. Senator Grassley was even more emphatic. "There's no doubt the new intelligence assessment was a political hit that had been ordered by President Obama." Both Clapper and Brennan have been told by federal prosecutors they are targets of investigation and have been subpoenaed by the grand jury looking at conspiracy charges. In a letter from his attorney, Brennan said he has cooperated with the probe, turning over documents requested for the period July 2016 to February 2017. Brennan says he stands by the ICA and intelligence community assessment and complained that he is the target of a manufactured criminal investigation. Attempts to reach Clapper for comment were unsuccessful. Oval Office planning session. The first week in January 2017 was a busy time at the Obama White House. On January 5th, Obama told a meeting with Comey and other officials during which they discussed using the Logan Act, a little-used 18th-century law that criminalizes efforts by private citizens to conduct American foreign policy against Trump's incoming national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Later that month, Comey dispatched Strzok to the West Wing to ambush Flynn in an interview that would set up a perjury trap leading to his ouster and indictment on charges that were later dropped. More significantly, they also discussed a plan to confront President-elect Trump with false allegations from the Steele dossier, which Comey presented as intelligence. On January 6th, Comey briefed Trump on Russia-related allegations, including those in the now-debunked Steele dossier, the same day the administration released an unclassified version of the ICA to the public. Comey's private meeting with Trump was later leaked to the press, lending credence to the dossier and giving Washington journalists official cover to publicize its transparently bogus rumors, starting with BuzzFeed, which published the entire Steele dossier on January 10th. On January 12th, still under the direction of the Obama administration, Comey also sought the renewal of a wiretap warrant to continue spying on Trump advisor Carter Page as a suspected Russian agent. The same day, the Bureau received an intelligence report warning of false information in the dossier that put Page under suspicion. And Comey knew by that point the dossier was based on fabrications by Steele's paid primary subsource. Later that month, Comey investigators learned that while interviewing Igor Danchenko, a former Brookings Institution analyst who worked as Steele's primary researcher, the key allegations in the dossier were nothing more than bar talk. Comey nevertheless approved the affidavit, underpinned by those same dossier lies, to electronically eavesdrop on Page for another 90 days. Senator Grassley stated, with all those red lights flashing stop, the Obama administration went full speed ahead. Some former prosecutors see a conspiracy in the unequal investigative treatment of Clinton and Trump, and they place Obama at the center of it. Swecker, a former prosecutor and top FBI official, stated, there are reasonable grounds for an investigation to determine if this was part of a broader conspiracy to protect Hillary Clinton and influence the election by smearing Trump at the same time. He told RCI, additionally, I don't think there's any doubt Obama was the mastermind behind the whole conspiracy. The problem is proving it. Trump leveled similar allegations last year, even going so far as to accuse the 44th president of treason. Obama spokesman Patrick Roenbush dismissed the accusations as bizarre and ridiculous. Hannah Hankins, now acting spokesperson for Obama's post-presidency office, told RCI, I won't have anything new to add for this story. Next up, author Josh Hammer writes, is this the end of transgender hysteria? A few years ago, things looked pretty bleak for skeptics of transgenderism, those of us who have great compassion for those afflicted by what the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders long referred to as the disorder of gender dysphoria, but who refuse to accept the lie that a man can become a woman or a woman can become a man. During the 2020 presidential race, then-candidate Joe Biden tweeted, transgender equality is the civil rights issue of our time. As president in 23, Biden followed up by stating, transgender people are some of the bravest Americans I know. That same year, the transgender fad achieved unprecedented reach among impressionable youngsters, while Gallup reported that an already high 7% of all Americans identified as LGBTQ, that number soared to 20% of all Generation Z, as high as 38% on some elite Ivy League campuses. But the social craze began to face setbacks. In the United Kingdom, the National Health Service's CASS review cast a substantial doubt on the underlying scientific evidence purporting to support gender-affirming care. Enterprising investigative journalists, such as Christopher F. Rufo, began to expose rampant ethical concerns with America's gender clinics. polling began to reflect broader concerns with the transgender narrative on issues such as women's athletic competition. President Donald Trump, intuiting that the law can shape culture just as culture can shape law, signed numerous transgender-related executive orders in the first few weeks of his second term. Now it seems the dam may be breaking. In a landmark legal judgment on January 30th, a 22-year-old biological woman named Fox Varian was awarded $2 million in Westchester County Supreme Court. Varian, a detransitioner, had an irreversible double mastectomy when she was 16 years old. The New York court held her psychologist and surgeon liable for $1.6 million for past and future suffering, and an additional $400,000 for any future medical expenses. Varian, whose mother emphatically opposed the operation, but consented following the surgeon's emphatic insistence, became deeply depressed following the procedure. Now she has become the first transitioner to win a medical malpractice lawsuit at trial. The message out of the Westchester County is clear. Doctors and psychologists are now potentially on the hook for irrevocable mutilation of patients in the name of gender ideology. The response has been swift. On Tuesday, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons became the first major medical association to recommend that transgender surgeries be delayed until a patient is at least 19 years old. Immediately, the American Medical Association, in a statement to National Review, reversed its previous enthusiasm for teenage gender-affirming care. The AMA now, quote, agrees with the American Society of Plastic Surgeons that surgical intervention in minors should be generally deferred to adulthood. Close quotes. On Thursday, the American Academy of Pediatrics followed suit, stating the guidance for the American Association of Pediatrics for healthcare for young people with gender dysphoria does not include a blanket recommendation for surgery for minors. Transgenderism is having a tough time on the legal front as well. In the United States versus Scrimeti, a 6-3 Supreme Court majority held that Tennessee's comprehensive ban on transgender-related medical procedures passes constitutional muster. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, one of the more centrist Republican-nominated jurists, went out of her way to argue in a concurring opinion that transgender-identifying individuals do not constitute a suspect class or discrete and insular minority in the court's 14th Amendment jurisprudential jargon, that such that heightened judicial scrutiny is required. This term at the High Court, Idaho and West Virginia, recently defended their own laws that prohibit biological males from competing in women's sports. Most court watchers expect the two states to prevail. The fundamental problem for transgender activists was always easy to spot. Transgenderism is premised on a lie, and in the long run, the truth has a stubborn tendency to prevail. We know the biological truth of sexual dimorphism, the chromosomal truth of the dichotomous XX and XY structure, the biblical truth that God created man in his image, male and female he created them, millennia of unquestioned human experience, and basic common sense that there are precisely two sexes. That is not to deny that there are intersex or androgynous individuals, there are and always have been. And that is not to deny the very real psychological malady of gender dysphoria. But one cannot change his or her sex by subjectively identifying as such or by subjecting himself to either hormonal treatments or a surgeon's knife. It is simply not possible. And the notion that it was ever possible, advanced by so many cultural and societal elites for so many years, was always going to end in pain, suffering, massive legal liability, and the desecration of the Hippocratic Oath-based medical profession itself. Cliques and fads may sometimes rule the day, but the truth is eternal. Kudos to the American people for beginning to realign political, legal, and social mores with the truth. Next up, Scott McKay writes, because it's inappropriate, that's why. In 2019, the NFL turned its Super Bowl halftime show over to Jay-Z and his production company, Rock, R-O-C-K, R-O-C, Nation, and something irritatingly predictable has happened ever since. You saw a good example of it Sunday night when Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny put on a show that has torn the country right down the middle and has set Americans into each other's throats. More on that in a minute, but what should be remembered is that the Bad Bunny spectacle of this year was nothing compared to the one 4 years ago, in which an all-star cast of hip-hop or superstars headed by Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre, Eminem, Mary J. Blige, Kendrick Lamar, and 50 Cent put on a pan to gangster rap, complete with glorification of the inmates in the Los Angeles County Jail. Everybody loves Snoop Dogg, so the outrage was muted. But the NFL is supposed to be an aspirational alternative to prison for lots of underprivileged people. It's supposed to encourage folks to focus hard work, apply their talents with discipline and effort, and make something of their lives. And the inmates in that jail generally had none of those things. And yet the NFL was celebrating street criminals at the halftime of the Super Bowl. And that jailbird symphony was highly acclaimed. It begat the mess on Sunday. As artistic expression, it must be said, Bad Bunny's show wasn't bad. The music was reggaeton, which is generally pretty fun stuff. It's high energy, it's pretty listenable, although the fact that Bad Bunny will hardly utter a word of English on the stage makes for a bit of a WTF factor, and the short play encompassing the halftime show, which is something like a day in the life of Puerto Rico, was nothing if not creative. There was a wedding. There were people chopping sugarcane. Poor folks shopping at a bodega with We Accept EBT in neon on the window. And if you know a little about Puerto Rico and its problems, this was amusing, a satirical takedown of the putrid performance of the island's power grid, complete with the line workers dangling from power poles and a transformer explosion. If this had been a video promoting tourism in Puerto Rico, or if it were a Netflix special, you'd say it was kind of cool. Now, the fact that it was in Spanish, as I noted above, cast this whole enterprise in a strange light. The NFL's audience doesn't speak much Spanish. It's an English-speaking league. There are no NFL teams in cities where the majority of people speak Spanish. Houston, Miami, and L.A. have large Spanish-speaking populations, yes, but they're American cities where the schooling and the business and the government work, and the culture are all done chiefly, if not exclusively, in English. The Latin citizens in those places, many of whom are big football fans, speak English. But Bad Bunny didn't. He threw out a few words of English here and there, but the act was in Spanish, except for the short cameo in which we were subjected to the satanic Lady Gaga. Thanks a lot for that. And the Spanish-speaking spectacular masked the fact that Bad Bunny's lyrics were utterly filthy and pornographic and subjectively objectifying in a way that feminists generally would abhor. One of the more hilarious things on Sunday night was to watch woke leftists explode in ecstasy on Facebook and X over the halftime show without having the first clue what they were applauding. Bad Bunny cleaned up the lyrics to the songs he performed Sunday night a little, but generally speaking, if those had been in English, there would have been a problem. And the show ended with a recitation of all the countries in the Western Hemisphere, with the U.S. and Canada named last, an assertion, we are all America. Which was a very unmistakable in-your-face to the mainland USA. It was, as some have called it, a humiliation ritual, a Latin supremacist message. After presenting Latin life in a person of the mini Puerto Rico set assembled on Levi's stage field as poor and crappy. And the thing is that if that's Bad Bunny's act, that's fine. He's Puerto Rican. He wants to push Puerto Rican culture. No problem. But that culture has nothing to do with the NFL. So far as I know, the NFL has never played a game in Puerto Rico. If there's organized football on that island, American football, I mean, not football where you can't use your hands, it isn't on a particularly high level. So how is it appropriate to push Latin American culture, exclusionary Latin American culture at that, on the one remaining, as in the United States of America, cultural event celebrations, our own history and heritage? Nothing is more uniquely USA than the Super Bowl, and it has to be taken over by others who don't speak the language? Yes, I know Puerto Rico is part of the USA. You can put that tired line to bed. The end of the show made it clear Bad Bunny wasn't just talking about Puerto Rico. He was pushing Bolivia and Cuba and Nicaragua as well, which is, of course, a metaphor for the Latin invasion that the American people elected Donald Trump to reverse. Now we're told the whole hemisphere is America, and therefore we aren't allowed to have a border. If the NFL thinks it's so damned important to penetrate the Latin market, then how come it hasn't started any football leagues in Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, and South America? You would think that's the easiest way to develop an audience for NFL football. Get people playing the game and then falling in love with it. And they'd necessarily then want to watch it played at the highest levels. Instead, they spend a hell of a lot of money more trying to get, they spend a hell of a lot more time trying to get girls in the U.S. to play flag football and push that like it's just as good as men playing it. Roger Goodell had better not say that having Bad Bunny play the Super Bowl is an outreach to Latin America. That's BS and everybody knows it. Do some real outreach and then get back to me. We're seeing this kind of thing everywhere, and it's terribly dishonest. I could have written this column a few days ago, and I almost did, when it came out that Lupita Nyong, the Kenyan-Mexican actress who's been in a number of movies and TV shows, is cast as Helen of Troy in Christopher Nolan's upcoming The Odyssey feature. I like Lupita fine, and I agree that she's very pretty, and she certainly has acting talent, but casting her of Helen of Troy is absurd. She isn't Greek. Yes, I know that neither is Diane Kruger, who played Helen in Troy. Diane Kruger is German. And while I liked her a lot as well, that was also lousy casting. The Trojans were Greeks, the stories were from Greek myths, and the cast of the movies made about the Iliad and the Odyssey should be or look Greek, or at least Mediterranean. Out of respect to Greeks, whose culture is being appropriated. Helen Kruger is a fit for British adaptation of the original text from Homer, in which she was disguised as a blonde with fair skin. By the standards of modern cultural priggishness, we should reject that just as loudly as the idea that Kenyan Mexicans are Greeks. And we have to have this debate because Christopher Nolan took it on the chin a few years back when he didn't cast any black people in Dunkirk, so he gave him Helen of Troy. This isn't about Lupita. It's just like it isn't about Benny. It's about the higher-ups making decisions about culture and deliberately sabotaging it, sanding down off all the edges and contour that make the Western civilization what it is. The Greeks have to surrender their myths for the world's participation and consumption. The U.S. has to accede to having Super Bowl swallowed by open borders crowd. The Brits could well have a prime minister wearing a hijab by the end of the year. And the Spanish and French are literally importing foreigners in the millions for purposes of voting. Is it a surprise that Japan took the hardest turn to the right since the end of World War II? The Japanese aren't stupid. They see the world for what it is, and they've decided they don't want any part of it. And they'll be armed to the teeth in no time flat. And most certainly, Japan's birth rate will rebound along with their newfound national identity. Turning Point USA saw the Bad Bunny spectacle coming together and threw together a halftime show of their own, starring Kid Rock. Between Turning Point's YouTube channel and Charlie Kirk's channel, the show was sitting at 24 million views in the first 15 hours it was available, and it was on other platforms as well. The NFL's cultural arsonist defenders are scoffing that TPUSA show was a bust. They're saying that Bad Bunny halftime show is a massive win because of the controversy it started and the fact that it won the competition with Kid Rock et al. Validates this debacle. I'm no marketing genius, to my eternal regret, but I do know this. Controversy is a marketing tool, something that works when you're building a brand, when you're an outsider looking in. Getting the gig as producer or performer of the NFL's halftime show is as literally as inside looking out as it's possible to be. In that scenario, controversy is failure. And those 24 million views for the Turning Point USA show are people who either openly rejected the NFL's provocative choices or at least showed themselves open to alternatives. That's an indication that a lot of people have had it with things that are not appropriate, although it's going to be a while before we know if the message is received. Next up, author Itzu Diaz writes, I'm a Spanish taxpayer. This is why the West doesn't need to reward illegal immigrants. Spain has just announced the regularization of 500,000 undocumented immigrants. Pedro Sanchez published in an article in the New York Times on Thursday, I'm the Prime Minister of Spain, this is why the West needs migrants, congratulating himself on the measure, but his piece included several inaccuracies and omissions, as well as a bunch of nonsense, as is usual from that author. In reality, the proposed regularization will affect closer to 1 million undocumented immigrants, a figure that could soon rise to 2 million thanks to family reunification policies. While this is theoretically a matter for each state, Giorgia Meloni has asked the EU to halt the regularization to prevent a surge of undocumented migrants in the Mediterranean. This is an irresponsible project that social communist government is pushing through by force using the legal mechanism of decree law to bypass debate in Congress where it lacks the support to pass. This is exactly the same as dictators do. Sanchez leans on the argument that Spain was once a country of emigrants, but that's a trap. Yes, Spaniards emigrated to the Americas and other parts of Europe in the 20th century seeking prosperity, but that migration was far more orderly and regulated. Most left Spain with state-managed contracts. By contrast, Spain was then a poor but European and stable country, whereas a significant portion of today's immigration comes from failed states, extreme structural poverty, or war, and unlike Spaniards who are heading to Switzerland or Argentina, many arrive with a minimal willingness to adapt, unless you consider machete attacks in the streets a literal friendly invitation to mix with Spanish blood. Spain needs immigration with guarantees, people coming with work contracts, no criminal records, and willing to adapt. Otherwise, public services teeter on the brink of collapse, and sustaining the welfare state will become increasingly difficult. For instance, since 2000, the population has grown by 20%, while per capita investment in infrastructure has dropped by 38%. These figures are central to the debate in Spain following a recent train accident that killed 46 people and exposed the deterioration of the railway system under Sanchez's administration. Crime is also a major concern. The government will not require criminal record certificates from undocumented immigrants benefiting from this measure, only a sworn statement denying any criminal activity. Police unions consider this a bad joke. Furthermore, Sanchez's social policies encourage many immigrants not to work. Once regularized, an unemployed immigrant will have access to minimum living, regional aid, housing assistance, full public health care, and school meal grants for the children. Often the difference between working job or not is earning $330 while dedicating 40 hours a week to a low-quality job. Immigrants know perfectly well that if they work, they lose the benefits. Sanchez claims Spain is enjoying a period of prosperity, but family economics tell a different story. The cost of groceries has risen 45.6% since 2019. Sanchez has imposed more than 100 new taxes during his term, with 80% of the burden falling on the middle class and self-employed, and net wages have fallen by an average of 2.5%. He ends his article with an appeal to charity, which brings to mind one of Javier Milei's most famous videos from before he became president. I'll skip those 50 or so curse words delivered in barely 15 seconds and focus on the message. Quote, if those in government want to do charity, let them do it with their own damn money. Not even the socialist supporters of regularization to answer this question. What message are you sending to future immigrants after granting legal status to those who enter by breaking the law and violating our borders? Anyway, I, just like Sanchez, have found a fair and quick solution to this situation. Let the New York Times, which will only act as a megaphone for Europe's biggest liar, host that 1 million illegal immigrants in its offices. That's a win-win. Everybody's happy. Next up, Roger Kimball writes, Trump's senior appointments are making government great again. Has Donald Trump 2.0 assembled the best circle of advisors in the history of the American Republic? George Washington had Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State and Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury. Impressive. But is it any more impressive than having Marco Rubio as Secretary of State or Scott Bessent as Secretary of the Treasury? Jefferson and Hamilton are at the tippy top, but largely for the same reason that Samuel Johnson said that Homer was the greatest poet, because they came first. As Homer was foundational for the Western poetic tradition, so Hamilton and Jefferson are foundational for America. And of course, Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, which puts him in a category by himself. That said, Rubio and Bessent have emerged as among the best cabinet secretaries in history. Watching Rubio school Congress and the obtuse media about serious issues like Venezuela, Iran, and Gaza reminds one of what Horace said about the aim of poetry. It should delight as well as instruct. Rubio has done both. Part of the delight is Rubio's commanding way with the obstreperous media. He's been aided by a fermenting internet. At the moment, Rubio is not only Secretary of State, but also National Security Advisor and head of the National Archives. For several months, he also ran USAID. The many hats have been a gift to memers who have lavished in delighting ever more jobs on his shoulders. Starting with a stolid-looking Rubio sitting in the Oval Office, the memes show us Marco Rubio realizing he will be the new governor of Minnesota / president of Venezuela / governor of Greenland / supreme leader of Iran, etc. Equally delightful is Scott Bessent, who is not only Secretary of the Treasury, but also Acting Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. Bessent's quiet, decorous manner conceals, or rather semi-conceals, a biting wit. His recent fencing match with Congress left him the clear victor. His exchanges with Maxine Waters, Elizabeth Warren, and Greg Meeks were classics. Then there was this response to Representative Stephen Lynch, who kept shouting questions at Bessent. Could you speak a little louder, said Bessent. I can't hear you. But the excellence of Trump's cabinet and other senior aides goes beyond Marco Rubio and Scott Bessent. Indeed, the entire cabinet is superb. Just a day or two back, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth warmed the cockles of my heart with his announcement that henceforth the military was ending its long association with Harvard University. How long? Hegseth points out that George Washington took command of the Continental Army in Harvard Yard. The university has more Congressional Medal of Honor winners than any other civilian institution. But in recent years, Hegseth noted, the university has become one of the red-hot centers of hate America activism. It has ties with the Chinese Communist Party, has openly supported the terrorist group Hamas, and has, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's decision outlawing the practice, continued to support the racist practice of DEI. In short, like the other Ivy League and Ivy-adjacent institutions, Harvard no longer lives up to its founding principle. Harvard is woke, and the War Department is not, Hegseth said. He stated, "Too many faculty members openly loathe our military. They cast our armed forces in a negative light and squelch anyone who challenges their leftist political leanings, all while charging enormous tuition. It's not worth it. They've replaced open inquiry and honest debate with rigid orthodoxy." For many years, the military has sent many of its best officers and senior enlisted men to Harvard for continuing education. No more. Starting in 26-27 school year, Hegseth said, "I am discontinuing all graduate-level professional military education, PME, all fellowships, certificate programs between Harvard University and the War Department for active duty service members." Hurrah for that. And it is not just Trump's cabinet members who are doing yeoman's work, helping to implement his agenda. So are senior advisors like Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's Director of National Intelligence. Because election security is national security, Trump has tapped Gabbard to oversee the coordinated whole-of-government effort to ensure that our elections are fair and transparent moving forward. Last week, when the FBI raided the Fulton County, Georgia election office and made off with some 700 boxes of ballots and other election materials, a photograph of Gabbard talking on her cell phone in front of the swag took the internet by storm. It did so because it signaled the Trump administration was taking the inquiry with the utmost seriousness. Gabbard's presence meant that the raid was not just about fraudulent ballots in Georgia, nor was it about the 2020 election. It was about the corruption of the intelligence community as a whole and beyond, that the corruption of senior political actors, how do you spell Obama? As Gabbard noted, there are many people still inside the intelligence agency who are actively trying to keep the truth buried. As one of my new favorite bloggers put it, Gabbard's disclosure showed the bleeding id of the authoritarian mind exposed. They don't fear fraud being uncovered. They fear fraud being proven. Alas for them, many more revelations are coming. And with those revelations, as Gabbard stressed, will come accountability. Bottom line, Trump is not only making America great again, he is also making government great again. His senior appointments make up an all-star team that is rapidly recovering the American dream. Trump is likely to have them, and not as lucky as the American people are. In our wrap-up article for this week from American Spectator, Jeffrey Lord writes, "Schumer plays the race card. It isn't rocket science, and New York's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer knows it. With Republicans pushing for voter ID to make sure elections are above board, Schumer has moved to shut down the very possibility that Americans, who must produce an ID for everything from buying booze to getting on a plane and more, must produce an ID to vote. Says Schumer, it's Jim Crow 2.0, and I call it Jim Crow 2.0, and the right wing went nuts all over the internet. That's because they know it's true. What they're trying to do here is the same that was done in the South for decades to prevent people of color from voting. The it here is voter ID. To start, note well what Schumer mysteriously ignores when he says what they're trying to do here is the same thing that was done in the South for decades to prevent people of color from voting. Curiously, Schumer leaves out the blatant history that it was Schumer's Democratic Party that prevented people of color from voting in the South. The hard historical fact here is that Schumer's Democratic Party is, in fact, the party of race. It was founded, yes, by slave owners, and when slavery was ended forcibly, called the Civil War, over the objections of the Democratic Party, the party turned to instituting segregation. It used the Ku Klux Klan as its military arm, the KKK once playing a key role in early 20th century Democratic politics. It was, in hard fact, Democrats who kept African Americans from voting, and a whole lot more as well. And now, here in the 21st century, it's the Democrats who have made the sons of segregation, identity politics, and so-called DEI essential to their continuing politics of race and racism. Note as well this headline from over at VOR News. Democrats' stance on voter ID described as racist by many blacks. And over at Newsmax was this from columnist Michael Dershowitz. Dems insult voters' history by calling voter ID Jim Crow 2.0. Dershowitz writes, comparing photo ID and proof of citizenship requirements to the Democratic Party's own Jim Crow laws is laughable and a slap in the face to what emancipated slaves went through to exercise a fundamental right. To cut to the chase, the hard historical fact is that the Democrats have spent centuries from their party's founding by slave owners through their construction of segregation and now identity politics using race to win elections. All of this and not a word of apology to black Americans, which actually raises a question thanks to Senator Schumer. The question? Will Senator Schumer issue a formal apology to black Americans for his party's support of slavery, segregation, the Ku Klux Klan, and now identity politics? Don't wait up. Instead, Schumer has chosen to play the race card. But of course he did. And that is a wrap-up for American Spectator for this week. I do hope that you have enjoyed listening to these articles as much as I have had in reading them for you. I'll give you a couple of teaser titles for our next broadcast. The Save Act. Why are Senate Republicans dithering? Confederate Liberals. Interesting. Is another one. Newsom practically demands to be the Democratic candidate. That by author Ellie Gardy Holmes. The Democrats' conditional loyalty, a republic if we can keep it. These and more I'll be bringing your way in our next broadcast. Again, thank you very much for listening. Have a wonderful day.